Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Blood Atonement by S.M. Friedman. Narrated by Tanya Eby. Prologue. Grace was cleaning blood from her thighs when the police raided Brigham for the last time. At first, she paid little attention to the shouting outside the trailer window. She needed to finish what she was doing before her husband came home demanding dinner. She'd propped herself over the toilet, one hip wedged into the side of the sink and her back pressed against the shower door. Her legs shook, her hands trembled. Her brain was hot with fever, and her good ear buzzed. Someone pounded on the side of the trailer, causing the walls to rattle. She lurched backward and grabbed the edge of the sink to keep from falling. Bloody rags splatted on the floor.
"Grace, hurry! The police are here," Desiree said.
The police? Now she heard the shouting, the crying, the chaos as children scattered into the forest.
"I'm here. I'm coming. Be quick."
Her dress hung from the hook by the sink, pale green with yellowed lace trim. But there was no time for her to get dressed. She grabbed a throw blanket from the foot of the bed and wrapped it around herself to cover her blood-soaked temple undergarments. The world tipped sideways and slowly righted itself. Staggering forward, she somehow made it to the door and slammed a shoulder into it, unsticking the warped aluminum from its frame. She tumbled off balance down the outside stairs and would have fallen if her sister hadn't caught her.
"Come on!"
Desiree grabbed her arm and pulled. They ran beneath a moon that was low and bright in the sky. Once Grace's eyes adjusted, she could see perfectly well, which meant she could also be seen perfectly well. At the edge of the cornfield, reason or madness asserted itself.
"Wait."
Desiree spun to face her, eyes wide with panic.
"What are you doing? We have to go."
Her sister's hair was pulled into a classic roll on top of her head and braided down her back. She panted, her bosom pressed against the cotton of her high-collared dress. Pimples dotted her chin. How long until Uncle G had a revelation about Desiree's marriage? She was already a year older than Grace had been. Desiree glanced toward the road.
"Come on, they're catching up."
This was true. The beams of their flashlights danced like fireflies as the police approached. Their voices grew louder. She felt Desiree's panic, could feel it swell within her own chest. The urge to keep running was almost overwhelming. It's what they'd been taught to do. They needed to protect their way of life, their chance at heaven, and their prophet. But blood trickled down her legs. Again. And more than anything, she wanted a better life for her sister. She grabbed Desiree's hands. Hers blazed with fever. Desiree's felt like ice. "This is our chance." Realization and fear blossomed in Desiree's eyes. She shook her head and tried to pull her hands free.
"We shouldn't,"
Grace squeezed.
"We must." "But what about father and mother?"
Grace's chest tightened with anxiety and guilt, but she shook her head. Too far down that path, and she'd decide to stay. Then her only way out would be death. She opened her mouth, but nothing came out. Truth was so hard to speak. She'd been raised to be sweet, and the words burned like acid on her tongue. She almost gagged on the enormity of what escaped her lips.
"If I have to stay here any longer, I'll die, and so will you. How long until you're married?" "Oh, Grace."
Desiree's eyes swam with tears. "You're 14. Your revelation is coming any day now.
Maybe I'll be lucky, like our parents were."
"Until Mother Rebecca joined the family." Desiree swallowed hard.
"Was it just a game to you?"
Grace asked. The police drew closer, the beams from their flashlights weaving and flickering.
"I know you're scared, but we can't waste this chance. The others will be waiting for us."
Desiree licked her lips, bobbing her head up and down.
"All right. If they're really there, I'll do it."
She wrapped an arm around her sister's waist, and together they ran along the edge of the cornfield. As Grace had predicted, the others were huddled beneath the scarecrow on the far end, but a quick head count told her only 8 had made it. Grace rubbed a trembling hand across her brow. It came away wet. Her bones felt hollow, and she could barely hear over the ringing in her good ear.
"Where's Soraya?"
No answer. Just 8 sets of eyes, begging for her leadership.
"Oh no, she...
Desiree's jaw tightened and spittle flew from her mouth. Her stammer always got worse under stress. She shook her head.
We need to go look for her.
The police lights grew distant, but somewhere nearby, men shouted. It sounded like Uncle Red and maybe Joseph Barlow. They'd be rounding up the children, herding them to the forest.
There's no time. We have to go,
Rulon said. He was Uncle G's sixth son and her husband's half-brother. They had the same blonde hair and pale eyes, but her husband was salt to Rulon's sugar. Desiree spoke through her fingers. We can't just leave her.
It won't be for long, Rulon said. Once we tell our story, they'll come back to rescue the rest.
Maybe she's already waiting on the road, Tabby said.
Joseph Barlow spotted them and strode across the cornfield in their direction.
What are you doing there? All of you, to the forest.
Hurry, everyone buddy up, Grace said. Stay with me.
Hey,
Barlow called after them. They rolled like thunder across the fields and gravel, linked hand to hand. Grace's legs trembled with exertion, threatening to collapse beneath her. But the others depended on her, so she pushed forward. They made it to the main road with no sign of Soraya. Up close, the police looked terrifying. They moved in formation, wearing dark helmets and thick vests. One by one, she felt the others slow. Paralyzed by the same fear that bloomed inside her own chest, this was their enemy in the flesh. An officer stepped out of formation and pulled off his helmet. He had a shock of dark hair above a broad face. Their eyes met, and his arms opened as though in welcome. She squeezed Desiree's hand and pulled Tabby close. The girls trembled against her side, thin as sparrows.
Don't be afraid. God is with us.
She ran toward the officer's open arms, and the children followed. 1. The new goat had foot rot. Grace could smell it. The local vet had brought the goat to her the day before. Some jackass in Arrowhead had bought her without any clue how to raise goats, and had kept her in a pen without fresh grass or even a rock to climb on, hence the terrible state of her hooves. The poor thing had been abandoned at the clinic the previous week with a serious case of bloat, which was life-threatening if left untreated. Come on, she tugged on the goat's lead. A good-sized young son, and she would make a nice addition to the flock if Grace could fix those hooves. Her service dog, Bella, hauled herself upright and loped along beside them to the barn. The new goat wasn't producing yet, but the milking area was good for trimming hooves as well. All right, dearie, let's get those feet cleaned up. The poor girl was understandably antsy, bucking and shaking. Bella drew closer, putting the pressure of her big body to use by leaning into the goat. It worked as well on the goat as it did on Grace. She led the Sonnen into the milking stall, closed the gate, and reached over to give Bella a grateful scratch behind the ears. Once the St. Bernard had received enough appreciation, she flopped onto a giant pillow and closed her eyes. As Grace pulled on her gloves and sat on the bench beside the goat, she spoke in a gentle, conversational tone. She lifted the goat's left hind foot, gave it a wash, and used the orange-handled trimmers to slice away slivers of the hoof. The rot didn't go too deep, thank goodness. She trimmed the sidewall and leveled it so the goat would have an easier time walking, scrubbed it with udder wash and the lavender tea tree power combo, then moved on to the right rear foot, repeating the process. The front hooves were in better shape, requiring minimal trimming. She released the goat back into the yard with a friendly pat on the rump. Buckeye bleated his way toward her, looking for treats, and allowed her to give him a quick pat on the head before bounding away. The trees rustled with the promise of rain. She turned her face into the wind and breathed in the smell of lake and pine. She could also smell the metallic tang of an impending storm, and her brow creased with worry. Shelby was due in an hour. She hoped the storm held off until she'd arrived safely. When another damp gust swept through the trees, several goats screeched their discontent. En masse, they moved toward her at the gate. They hated nothing more than getting wet. All right, she reached for her leads. Let's get you guys inside. Two at a time, she led them into the barn. Bella trotted contentedly at her side. A rumble of thunder set the goats bleating with renewed panic, and she led the last two into the warmth of the barn, just as fat raindrops began to fall. Bella whined and nudged Grace's hand with her nose, then issued a sharp bark. It was the signal of brewing trouble. It's all right, girl. She pulled the lead from Buckeye's neck and looped it over the hook by the door. Let's head back to the house. Shelby will be here soon.
Bella whined again, nudged her in the ribs, and gave another sharp bark.
No, I'm all right.
It was true. Her ear wasn't buzzing at all, and she felt clear-minded and present. Perhaps the storm was upsetting the dog. She patted Bella's massive flank. The dog's fur curled in the damp, white and auburn, mixed with spots of black.
Bella came to an abrupt stop just outside the barn door, her body stiffening with alarm.
What's up, girl?
Bella's focus turned to the thick stand of cedar and hemlock near the cliff's edge. Her hackles rose, and she issued a low, rumbling growl.
Do you smell something?
A lot of wildlife roamed the area, deer and raccoons and even the occasional caribou. But given the dog's reaction, a grizzly bear was more likely. Grace cupped a hand over her eyes to keep out the rain and scanned the tree line. At a flash of movement to the left, Bella barked, deep and earth-shaking.
Bella, quiet.
The dog was well-trained. Her mouth snapped closed, but her body language didn't change.
Let's get home.
The rain came down harder by the second. Despite her words, Grace paused to scan the trees again. Her instincts were nowhere near as fine-tuned as Bella's, but even her hackles were rising.
Someone's watching us.
Time to get inside. Bella, heel. Bella moved to her side. Heads bent against the rain, they slogged home. The side yard was already a boot-sucking swamp. Lightning flashed, immediately followed by the rumble of thunder. Through gaps in the trees, she saw Upper Arrow Lake madly frothing far below. Hopefully Shelby had made it as far as Nacusp, where she could hole up until the storm passed. She stomped up the porch stairs and Bella followed, giving a full body shake that sprayed Grace with more water.
Thanks, girl.
She wiped rain from her eyes and froze. A scrap of paper was pinned to the screen door. The corners curled inward with dampness, cocooning the message within. At the sight of it, her head filled with cotton. The painless pressure set her eyes skittering from side to side. Her good ear buzzed. With fingers gone stiff, she plucked the note from the screen and unfurled the corners. Bella rumbled deep in her chest, in harmony with the storm. The note was written in block letters with blood-red ink. It looked like a child's careful script, with the R's reversed. Red was a scary color. It was forbidden.
Sweet sister, we must atone by blood before the kingdom of heaven.
The wind gusted, stirring the hair from Grace's neck and tickling her exposed skin with icy fingers. She let go of the scrap of paper, watching as it fell to the plank flooring with a lifeless splat. Bella issued a sharp bark.
It's okay. We're okay.
She fumbled for the door handle. Her hands looked strange. They were too big, too old. She knew what that meant. There was no time to close the door. In the kitchen, her boots slipped on the linoleum, and she went down hard. A chair clattered and fell. She moaned, closed her eyes. Bella whined and bumped her nose into Grace's side, pulling her from the fog and confusion. She rolled over, climbed to her feet. Why was she so heavy? And stumbled to the living room. She needed to get to the phone. Bella tried to push her toward the safety of the bedroom. She batted the dog away, picked up the phone's receiver, and hit the button to dial Shelby's cell phone.
Grace?
Shelby's voice crackled on the other end of the line. I'm almost there, but holy shit, this storm is exploding all around me.
I'm sorry. They're coming.
The phone dropped from her hand, and Shelby's voice grew tinny and distant. Thunder rumbled, and Bella growled.
2. The storm gobbles the land behind me. It pummels the trees with sideways rain, and the lake far below rages like the belly of the beast. I crouch beside the trunk of an enormous tree and pray for God's protection. A futile prayer. I am not yet worthy of Zion. The dog barks from the porch. It is a behemoth of fur and teeth, which makes me nervous. It is so big and loud. Headlights slice the yard, dance across the side of the barn, and come to a bouncing stop. It's the doctor, the psychologist. I recognize her jeep. The roof of the jeep is dark and slick with rain. The headlights flick off, leaving the yard in shadow. As she opens the door, the interior light reveals a guitar case propped in the back seat. She wears a yellow raincoat, not bright yellow, more like blighted sunshine. The hood covers her head and hides her face. She tucks her bag against her chest and runs for the porch. The doctor makes me nervous, too. But everything makes me nervous. The dog wags a tail as thick as a tree branch, and the doctor pats its head. I imagine her asking about the dog's master. Where is Grace? Is she all right? They go into the house, and the door closes. Soon they will be back. Soon they will begin to hunt. It is time to run. But for a moment, I stay still, yearning for the light and warmth. For safety. The door slams open. The doctor steps onto the porch. Her dark curls swirl about her head like Medusa's snakes. She bends to retrieve the note I've left, unrolls it, reads it. Her head snaps up, and she scans the trees at the edge of the property. Her gaze probes the darkness where I hide. She pulls up the hood of her coat and slaps a hand against her thigh, signaling for the dog. I've stayed too long. Skittering backward along the sodden ground, I climb to my feet. I learned to be swift and sure-footed during the police raids. Through the fence, across the field, into the forest, protect the family at all costs. Now, I disappear into the belly of the storm. Lightning sizzles overhead, and the angry crack of thunder shakes me to my bones. My feet slip on a sludge of wet leaves, and I stumble and fall. I land hard in the mud, and a thick tree root jabs into my ribs. But the praying tree is just ahead. Sometimes God leaves messages in the little hole at the base of the tree, telling me what I need to do to earn my place in Zion. I need God's word today. I need to feel that connection, that hope. I crawl toward the tree, through twigs and pine cones and mud and slugs. I dig into the dirt at the base of the tree, searching. There is no note. Tipping my face toward the canopy of trees, I beg for God's forgiveness. What more can I do to earn my place in Zion? Raindrops hit my cheeks, as though even God is crying over the state of my soul. 3. Since his wife's death, Beau's social life could be summed up by the sparse call history on his personal cell phone. The only number to show up with any frequency was for Evergreen House, where Emily's mother was living out the rest of her days. But this time when the phone rang, the number on the display screen wasn't familiar.
Yes?
There was an electronic hiss of escaping breath. He pictured the phone pressed tightly against someone's mouth. Detective Brunelli? The list of people who would call him detective on his personal cell phone was extremely short. Beau's heart gave a meaty ka-thump, and he put the grocery basket down so he could press the phone against his ear with both hands.
Who is this?
Desiree DeRoche. I don't know if you remember me.
How could he ever forget? Are you all right?
Is the line safe?
Her stammer brought back a flood of dead memories. Yes, what's going on?
Something bad, I think. Can you come here? I know it's Sunday. I'm just really scared.
Her voice was tearful and shaky. He was already moving, having abandoned his basket in the produce aisle. Where are you?
Cordova and Jackson.
She gave him the address. I'll be there in 15 minutes. The address Desiree had given was a three-level brick building spanning a whole block on the eastern edge of Vancouver's downtown east side. In nearby Oppenheimer Park, drug addicts and transients sunned their sallow skin. A chill was in the air, and soon many would move on to shelters and doorways to survive the winter. Desiree's apartment was on the third floor. On the way, Beau passed a clump of clothing and crumpled beer cans. The hallway carpet was stained with suspicious substances. A musty cat rubbed against his pants leg, the nubs of its spine clearly visible. Desiree waited in the doorway. Her hair was short, in a style he believed they called a pixie cut. Her features were gaunt, her nose straight and red-tipped, her eyes puffy. If not for the eyes, he could have mistaken her for her sister, Grace. With a nod, she welcomed him inside. He closed the door behind him and looked around in surprise. The juxtaposition between the rest of the building and her apartment was startling. The space was little more than a rectangle, with a living and dining room to the left and a wall of kitchen on the right. A hallway off the kitchen probably led to the bathroom and bedroom. The place was painted a sunny yellow with white trim. A love seat and chair in matching blue denim sat in the living room, wedged around a block of pine serving as a coffee table. Freshly cut geraniums sat on the windowsill.
Thank you for coming.
Her voice broke on the last word. She took a breath and tried again.
I didn't know if your number would still be good, or if you were still with the RCMP.
I'm in the serious crime section now.
When I heard about your wife, her left eyelid twitched, I meant to send a card.
What's going on, Desiree?
Is the case still active? I haven't heard anything for so long.
There are no new leads.
Desiree nodded with easy acceptance, which gave him a flash of frustration. He wished she'd grown enough past her childhood to demand more of him, to question how hard the RCMP was working to find their bishop and bring him to justice. He wished she'd get angry for once. Instead, she bit a raw spot on her bottom lip. A trickle of blood ran down her chin, unnoticed.
I received a note in the mail.
A squeeze of adrenaline hit his veins.
From whom?
She pulled a folded piece of newspaper out of the back pocket of her jeans.
I don't know.
He had her place it on the table and used the tip of his pen to unfold it. It was from the Vancouver Sun, dated the previous week. A man had jumped from the Lionsgate Bridge, a case that had barely crossed the periphery of his awareness. The deceased was listed as Stephen Bairns, 33 years old, of no fixed address. He'd jumped during afternoon rush hour. At the top of the article was a grainy photo of Stephen Bairns. Above, written in red marker in shaky block letters was,
Repent, JDBY 4:219.
Repent? You received this in the mail?
Uh-huh.
Any idea what JDBY and those numbers mean?
Journal of Discourses, Brigham Young. The text is, When your brothers or sisters commit a sin that must be atoned by the shedding of their blood, will you love them well enough to shed their blood?
Desiree bit more deeply into her lip. Beau pulled a tissue out of his pocket and handed it to her. She dabbed at the blood, her eyes on the scrap of newspaper.
Did you keep the envelope?
It's in my recycling bin, under the kitchen sink.
He grabbed a tissue from his pocket and lifted the envelope from the bin. Desiree's name and address had been scrawled in the same shaky block letters across the front of the envelope, the R's once again reversed. There was obviously no return address, but Canada Post could scan the barcode to see what part of the country it had been mailed from.
I'm not sure how long it was in my mailbox. I don't check it very often, so I only saw it today.
Do you recognize the handwriting?
No.
He scanned the article again, his eyes drawn to the red scrawl written across the top.
You don't recognize him, she said.
The man's hair was a pale color, either blonde or light brown, and he had a long straight nose, high forehead, and a pointed chin with a visible cleft.
It's Rulon.
She burst into tears, as though saying his name cracked the dam holding her emotions in check. She dabbed her cheeks with the bloody tissue, catching the falling drops. Rulon Smith. The boy had been named after former fundamentalist Mormon church prophet Rulon Jeffs, and had never been able to meet the high standard the name imposed upon him. He hadn't seen Rulon since he'd visited him in his foster home to tell him about his family's mass suicide. It was a particularly bad day.
It's been a while. Are you sure it's him?
Of course I'm sure.
May I keep this?
Desiree dabbed at a fresh slew of tears.
What if someone convinced him to jump?
Beau opened his mouth, then closed it again, considering. It certainly wouldn't be the first time, but was there anyone left to do it? Brigham was a graveyard, its residents buried en masse behind the temple.
She seemed to read his thoughts. You never found Uncle G.
His skin prickled with guilt.
No, we didn't.
Their bishop, Gideon Smith, had led the charge into fanatical martyrdom. They were under attack. Their kin in Bountiful were being persecuted. Their prophet, Warren Jeffs, had been arrested for arranging marriages between men and underage girls, and soon Smith would have stood trial on similar charges. Why? Because 10 of their own children had escaped and cooperated with the police. Brigham's 10, set to blow the roof off the secrecy behind Brigham and the FLDS Church. And Desiree DeRoche was one of them. At 14, she'd escaped Brigham's shadow, only to be burned by the ensuing legal clusterfuck. Her bravery had earned her a spot in the foster care system, and the hope of one day being forgotten. The fact that this seemed to be enough for her broke his heart. She chewed on her lip again.
If Uncle G's still alive,
Gideon Smith's body had not been found amongst the remains of Brigham's faithful. The RCMP had invested countless hours into tracking him down, and come up empty. But Bo would have laid a bet that the slimy son of a bitch was still out there somewhere.
I'll look into it. Are you in contact with any of the others?
Just Grace, a little bit.
Her cheeks flushed.
I'm still trying to make amends with her. I did a lot of bad stuff when I was on drugs.
Where does she live?
In the cusp. She's got an acre of land in the hills outside town. She has goats, and she makes cheese and yogurt and soap. And she sells her pottery.
Desiree spoke with a mixture of sisterly pride and bitterness.
Sounds like she's doing well.
Her mouth tightened, and fresh blood welled on her bottom lip.
Depends on your definition of well.
4. I'm glad you didn't call the cops, Grace said, easing into the deep armchair in her therapist's office without taking off her coat. The damp bit at her joints, and she couldn't get warm no matter what she did. She'd developed Lyme disease as a child, and naturally it had gone untreated. Even now, with better medicine and nutritional supplements, she was subject to the occasional flare-up. The symptoms were similar to the body aches and fatigue of fibromyalgia, and usually brought about by periods of extreme stress. Shelby leaned down to pat Bella's broad head. How are you doing, girl? Bella rumbled a contented response and settled near the fireplace, exposing her belly to the heat produced by the flames. Shelby took a piece of red licorice from the jar beside her on the table. The color made Grace anxious. What do you remember? Grace shook her head. There was something in the forest. A bear, maybe? Bella didn't like it. I remember her barking. She trailed off, stared at the merry crackle of the fire. She wished she could ease onto the floor next to Bella, curl up between the dog's heat and the fireplace, and sleep for about a month. Grace? She'd been working with Shelby 3 days a week for almost 2 years, since Dr. Goldberg had retired. The ink was barely dry on her diploma when Shelby took over his practice. Although Grace had felt nervous entrusting her complicated mind to someone who looked like a teenager, a fact that wasn't helped by the sticks of licorice permanently jammed into the corner of her mouth, Shelby had proved easy to talk to. It didn't take long for her quirky charm to put Grace at ease, and Shelby's ability to sense when she needed a push and when she needed space had helped cement her trust in the new therapist. She'd made more progress in the last 2 years than she had in all the years before that. The work was often painful and frequently terrifying, but as Shelby often said, there was only one way to go if she ever wanted to be whole, and that was through the thick of it. What happened before you called me? Shelby said. She turned her focus back to her therapist. The firelight danced across the tight coils of Shelby's hair, orange on black, and warmed the alabaster of her cheek. She could see her reflection in the dark of Shelby's eyes, and for a moment, she didn't recognize herself. Too old, and a girl. Can you check in? What was happening inside your body before you called me? Grace blinked, tried to focus. Sorry. It's okay. Take your time. I was scared. There was a fuzzy feeling in my head, like electricity, and that pressure that's not really a headache. My ears started ringing, and then my vision went dark. And what's the next thing you remember? Seeing you, Bella licking my face. I read the note, Shelby said. Okay, what do you think? Shelby volleyed back. What do you think? She chewed the skin beside her thumbnail. Shelby chewed her licorice. It could have been Harris, Shelby said. Then I'd like to talk to him. Her gaze turned to the fireplace, drawn to the dancing flames. Bella was snoring, her hind legs twitching. She wondered what the dog was dreaming about. Her eyes were heavy, her mind drowsy and slow. We're really tired. Why don't you close your eyes then? Shelby's voice softened into the soothing tones she used to guide her into hypnosis. She sank backward more quickly than usual. The sensation was similar to dunking her head in the bath, her ears plugged, her pores opened to the warmth, and the world she was leaving became distant. The lamplight waited, and mother's soft touch. Mother Susan died on the temple steps, in hearing distance of her husband's Sunday sermon.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?